Thank you. Marshall, can you call court to order, please?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Bradfold, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Today is October 6th, 2021. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have six cases on our calendar today. Four are set for oral argument. We are holding these via zoom.gov. These are being recorded. No other recordings are permitted, so please do not do so. Each party will have 15 minutes for their oral arguments, and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. All the rules of court will apply other than the ones that I had mentioned. If you run into any technical difficulties, we will make sure to accommodate you. That has happened on occasion. Hopefully that won't happen here. There is a timer, and hopefully both of you can see it to show how much time. Please be mindful of that so you know how much time is left for you. With that, counsel for appellant, you may state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Matthew Gilbert, G-I-L-B-E-R-T, representing appellant, Karen Warrington. May it please the court, Ms. Warrington, appellant, filed a motion to modify both spousal maintenance and child support in June of 2018. In her motion, she identified that the respondent had received a job promotion and his income had increased from $344,000 to $482,000, reflecting a 40% increase. While at the same time, her income had decreased from $167,000 to $89,568, reflecting a 46.5% decrease. At the same time, respondent had moved to Memphis, Tennessee, and he no longer lived in Edina, Minnesota. In Memphis, Tennessee, there is no income taxes that are paid. So there was a huge change in circumstances for the parties from a financial perspective. Not only that, the respondent had stopped exercising time with a minor child, and he hasn't seen the minor child since August of 2017. At the same time, respondent was not contributing to the monthly expenses of the minor child, which the district court had found was $3,022 per month. Ms. Warrington's motion was denied on appeal. This Court of Appeals reversed and remanded the case with very specific direction. Specifically, the Court of Appeals found in this case, for purposes of wife's spousal maintenance modification, the court should consider decreases to wife's income. The Court of Appeals further found in this case, the modification statute requires the district court to consider wife's current income and financial circumstances. Once it has determined wife's current income, and the statute requires the district court to compare the current income to the income findings in the 2017 judgment and decree. If wife cannot establish the statutory thresholds, then the district court shall determine whether the current order is unreasonable and unfair in the absence of the statutory presumptions, and shall make all factual findings necessary to support that determination. This court gave a very clear directive. Unfortunately, the district court did not apply that directive.
Can we talk a little more specifically about that directive? And I'm looking on page 3 of the decision from our court on March 30th. It seems to me that and I'm talking about the distinction between the argument about the granting of the modification of the support, but the denial of the modification to the maintenance order. And it seems like what you're asking us to do is contrary to what we directed on page 3 of Warrington 1. Because we explained that a determination of a substantial change in circumstance is a different inquiry for purposes of modifying maintenance as opposed to modifying support. And it looks to me like the district court did what we told them to do, what we told it to do on remand. And now you're asking us to do something different. or asking us to direct the district court to do something different.
Your Honor, the statute 518A.39 involves both, it's both a basis for modification of both spousal maintenance and child support. So it's the same statute, it's the same criteria. Remarkably, the district court found, and I quote, the disparity in the parties' incomes that existed at the time of the judgment and decree became very significant in the year after the dissolution while the parenting time schedule did not change. The disparity.
And I understand your argument and the apparent incongruity of the district court's order in granting one modification motion but denying the other. But it does look to me like we set forth the law of the case on page 3 of Warrington 1, and now you're asking us to do to say something different about what the law of the case is.
And Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with that. I think the directive was clear that the circumstances should have been looked at with regard to the income findings in the 2017 judgment and decree.
Where does it say that in Warrington 1?
On page 9 of that opinion. It specifically states once
the opinion, the opinion's only 6 pages long.
And I've got the quote, and maybe it's misnumbered. I apologize, but and the quote is, in this case, the modification statute requires the district court to consider wife's current income and financial circumstances. Once it has determined wife's current income, the statute requires the district court to compare the current income to the income findings in the 2017 judgment and decree. And that directive is wholly consistent with case law on that topic. Grabo, as well as, I forget the case off the top of my head, but essentially provides that when looking to modify a support obligation, you look at the factual finding from the last modified court order. And that's what the court directed. And with that, the court did direct the district court, the Court of Appeals directed the district court to apply the statutory presumptions. With that, the first presumption, 518A.392B1, subdivision 1, the court did find that that was applicable. The plain language of that statute applies it to any support order. And this is a matter of first impression before this court. I don't know how you can have a substantial change with regard to the party's circumstances and only modify child support without at least analyzing whether this change should result in the modification of spousal maintenance. Under the plain language of the presumption, it applies to both spousal maintenance and child support. Additionally, there's a second presumption, 518A.39 subdivision 2 part 5, which the court tried to analyze but didn't really analyze. The court incorrectly quoted the statute. The district court stated if there was a decrease in respondent's income of at least 20% more than she expected at the time of trial through no fault of or choice of hers, then the court is required to apply the two statutory presumptions to her motion for modification of spousal maintenance. Nowhere in the statute does it provide anything with regard to expected income, and the statute simply provides in part subdivision 2B5, there is a rebuttal presumption if the gross income of an obligor or obligee has decreased by at least 20% through no fault or choice of the party. There's no information in the record or there's no argument that's been made that Ms. Warrington's decrease in income has been through fault of her own. In addition to that, as a matter of law,
counsel, if you would just continue along that line, you're still talking about the 2018 motion to modify, right?
Correct.
Right. So we're talking strictly about the amount of maintenance at that point and the request to increase it. And it seems to me the district court's analysis turned on two things. One is, as you noted already in a challenge, the district court found no statutory presumption applied in that case, and I understand your focus on that, but the district court also looked at the Sysak case and said that because the change in income as to wife was not unexpected, in fact, it was specifically foreseen by her own testimony in the dissolution proceedings, That CISIC would suggest that any change in the husband's income is not sufficient to modify the maintenance.
And Your Honor, I mean, that's so under statute, it's any change. So it could be her increase in income. It could be his decrease in income. What happened here was both. CISIC is dissimilar to this case because that involved a permanent maintenance award and is pursuant to a stipulation where the parties had reached an agreement. Here, those circumstances were not present.
Well, I must not be following you, and maybe you just need to slow down. I know you practice in the area, and I probably just need some additional explanation. But it seems to me that, you know, either that CISIC does have some application here as to the request to modify, and where the district court finds that the change in wife's income is as anticipated in the dissolution decree, relying on the wife's own testimony, then I'm confused as to why, how we would resolve this, what you say is a question of first impression, without somehow overruling CISIC. And maybe you can explain the distinction a little more clearly for me.
Your Honor, I think that's a misnomer to say that her change in, or her loss in income was expected. There's no finding that the court finds that she's specifically going to reduce or have lesser income. There's no increase in maintenance in the decree consistent with a decrease in income. For that reason, there's just a finding that she.
So, counsel, I appreciate that that's your view of the record, but the district court's findings on that at page 12 of that opinion are pretty detailed. You know, the district court finds that there was actually a 19% increase in wife's income, and also goes over the testimony at the time of trial. So,
and Your Honor, again,
that were not true, then I agree with you. CISIC might not make a difference, but given that predicate, I'm struggling with your argument.
If you go back to the judgment and decree, there's no finding stating that she's going to have a decrease in income. In fact, we've cited numerous case law, including Nelson, which specifically says the district court cannot speculate in that regard. So it was just a comment that was mentioned in the decree. It's not that this is definitively going to happen. This is what she had testified to.
But that's what I'm struggling with that too. She testified that she was going to have a decrease in income. And that's what the district court found. Why is that? It almost sounds like you're saying don't rely on what she testified to previously.
And that's exactly what I'm saying, because the court never found that her income will in fact decrease. And again, there's numerous cases that we cited in our brief talking about how the district court can't rely upon, nor did it rely upon, what may happen in the future. There's lots of case law basically saying you got to come back if there's a change in circumstances, which is what happened here.
Right. But the district court also found that it had been a 19% decrease, not a 20% decrease. And so the statutory presumption did not apply.
So the district court used what she thought, what she speculated her income may be at the time of the motion here. And even if the court was impermissibly able to do that, she thought her income would be $150,000 per year at the time of the July 2018 hearing. And if that's the case, then her income had still decreased by about 40%.
So clearly, counsel, your argument as to the 2018 motion hinges on our determination that the district court was clearly erroneous. And I misstated the pages of the district court's order. I think the findings that we're all talking about are at pages 18 and 19 of that district court decision. So you're contending they're clearly erroneous, not supported by the record, right?
Well, to be clear, if you look at Nelson, I think this passage from Nelson is appropriate. With regard to not speculating regarding future events or income, the logic of this rule is clear. If parties are permitted to speculate as to future changes to their current conditions, the maintenance award would leave open the possibility that a party will receive maintenance on the basis of conditions that never came into existence. Here, if Janice is treated as if she was already retired, she would draw maintenance payments from Roger in an amount that would adequately supplement her income as if she were retired when continuing to work and enjoy income from her employment. Such a result is inequitable. Actual income and expenses is the touchstone for determining fair and reasonable maintenance. On remand, the court should consider her actual income. So again, when you read the decree, Judge Wall, who was the trial court judge, he simply noted that this is what she testified to, not that this was going to happen, not that the maintenance award would increase because of this expected decrease in income. And again, if you look at the applicable case law, it basically says we'll come back when a decrease is actually realized. At the same time, we do ask, if you look at just the dramatic change in circumstances between Mr. Warrington's income increasing by over 40%, Ms. Warrington's income decreasing by 46.5%, under Scott, we are asking this court to rule as a matter of law that that significant change in circumstances has rendered the existing award unfair and unreasonable. The district court has already made the requisite findings with regard to imputing income to Ms. Warrington of $89,000 per year, which is well more than the negative $12,000 that she made at the time of the last hearing. And I see I'm out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbert. And you all have five minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes and looks like we're set on the clock. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Ann Hansa, and I'm here this afternoon representing the respondent, John Edward Warrington. The issues before the court primarily relate to the appellant's request to modify the spousal maintenance, not only at the December 2018 motion hearing that was back on remand, but also the December for the October of 2020. As it relates to the motion in the remand motion, I would suggest to this court that the district court did exactly what the court asked it to do in what Your Honor was referring to as Warrington 1. The district court had to look at whether there had been a change in circumstance and had to identify, the court referred to it as the threshold, quantifiable thresholds. So I would suggest that the court did exactly what this court asked her to do. She looked at spousal maintenance and child support separately, because my read of 518A.39 says that the quantifiable thresholds for modifying child support are different than the quantifiable thresholds for spousal maintenance. 518A.39, subdivision 2B5, outlines the quantifiable threshold for spousal maintenance. And that states that there is presumed to be a substantial change in circumstance if the gross income of the obligor or obligee has decreased by at least 20% through no fault or choice of the party. 518A.39 subdivision 2B1 identifies the quantifiable threshold that the court district court has to apply when looking at a child support modification. And I don't think the court erred by failing to apply the child support quantifiable threshold to spousal maintenance. I won't spend a lot of time on child support because that issue isn't before you, but the district court did what this court asked her to do. She looked at what the income information was at the time of trial and compared it to the income information that was available to the court in June of 2018. She invited the Court of Appeals gave the district court the discretion to reopen the record. And in fact, she did. She said, I need more information to understand what decrease was expected in the appellant's income before the increase was to occur. And both parties supplemented the record. Appellant's own expert, Jennifer Leffler, submitted an exhibit at trial, which was in support of her request that, Judge Wall, my income is going to go down, and here's my projections for what it's going to go down to, and then how it's going to go back up. And I do find it troubling that appellant wanted the district court to rely upon that when it was setting the initial amount of spousal maintenance, and now is saying, oh no, it's just speculation, we shouldn't rely upon it at all. The district court at the time of the trial relied heavily on it and set the amount of spousal maintenance and the duration of spousal maintenance based on the specific representations made by the appellant. And I think the court appropriately determined that the statutory presumption for change had not been met based upon the income that the appellant submitted to the court. And it was supplemented because her original affidavit stated that her income was $89,568. There was some concern that there wasn't a 2017 tax return. She supplemented the record. And in fact, the 2017 tax return showed that her income reported on that tax return was $95,000. The district court properly compared that to what she said she was going to be earning. And because the expert report that appellant submitted didn't use calendar years, it used July of one year to July of the next year. But in the first half of 2018, according to her own expert's report, she projected her income to be $100,000. In the latter part of 2017, she projected her income to be $75,000. So the district court looked at that and said, in fact, the income that she's reporting under either scenario exceeded what she said it would decrease to, and there and therefore the only thing that the court needed to do was to determine whether the current court order regarding the spousal maintenance was unreasonable and unfair. And the court made extensive findings. Frankly, this court order is lengthier than the judgment and decree to support the conclusion that there had not been, that the terms of the current court order regarding spousal maintenance were unreasonable and unfair. The court concluded properly when they did the analysis that the child support needed to be modified. And in fact, the child support was modified. As it relates to the motion, the October motion, which is a separate and distinct analysis, the district court, determined that yes, in fact, the statutory presumption had been met by the appellant. And then the next thing they needed to determine was whether the respondent in the party had rebutted the presumption. And the district court made significant findings. When temporary maintenance is awarded, there's an expectation that the recipient will make a genuine good faith effort to rehabilitate. And I think that's the crux of the second motion to modify is twofold. One is that the court made extensive findings that the appellant not only failed to rehabilitate, but really took no action towards her goal or her aspiration of working and achieving the levels of income. And I think the court was also concerned about the side real estate business that she was devoting energy and time to, and able to, because of the way the money was coming in through a self-directed IRA, was able to sort of shield the money from the real estate business and then claim that she wasn't earning any income. The court made extensive findings about the appellant's failure to rehabilitate, the length of time that it took following the trial for her to even open the business, the fact that she had never applied for a job. She placed a lot of weight, the appellant placed a lot of weight on the argument that her ability to rehabilitate was seriously impacted, those were her words, by the fact that she was sole parenting a 16-year-old child. And the district court didn't find a lot of value in that argument, and in fact said that there's a lot of people that parent a child, especially a child that's away in boarding school for most of the time. And she did not find that the positions that the appellant put forward as to why she wasn't able to rehabilitate, to be credible. One of the ones was COVID-19. COVID-19 didn't start until March of 2020, a full 3 years after the divorce decree was entered. So it is my belief that the district court, did exactly what this court asked her to do. She got the information that she needed. She analyzed the record back in the 2018 motion. And then she also used the information to look at the new requests. And the new request is to make the spousal maintenance permanent and to increase it roughly 4 times over what the district court had ordered back in 2017. The district court found that appellant did none of the things that she testified at trial that she was going to do to reverse the downward trend of her income and become self-supporting. She's, and I think the district court was also confused and concerned by this real estate business. And frankly, I think we were all confused by what it was, but apparently she used her retirement dollars to create a self-directed IRA. She then invested in real estate and was involved fairly heavily in buying residential properties on the East Coast, renovating them, renting them out, ultimately selling them, and then argued that the income that she received in some months was over $12,000 a month, was not income that was available to her to meet her expenses because the way the IRS code reads is it's a self-directed IRA. Any of the income that she's earning has to be added back into her retirement accounts. And my argument is, I don't think the law allows for somebody to not take the action to make a good faith effort to become employed, to use the skills that she's used throughout her adult life, and then shield the income that she is earning through this real estate business by adding significant amounts to her retirement. And then also arguing, oh, well, I'm not earning any income in my employment, so the respondent should now supplement it. I don't think Mr. Warrington's the respondent in this matter. I don't know that his income really is relevant other than to the extent that the court found that there was a change in both parties' circumstances for purposes of calculating the child support. But I think the court properly analyzed and broke out the two modification motions separately, analyzed them separately, provided extensive findings of fact. And this is an abuse of discretion. The court looked at what was there, determined credibility. The first words she said before the hearing was, I've read 4,000 pieces of paper, which is essentially the volume of the submissions. So I would request that the court affirm the decision in its entirety with one exception. I would acknowledge that as it relates to the termination date on the child support, that the court made a clerical error. The child support in the court indicates that it will terminate when the minor child turns 18 or is deceased. I would submit to this court that it's a clerical error. It's curious to me that appellant didn't bring a motion for amended findings or ask the court to correct the clerical error. I was essentially precluded from bringing a motion to correct the clerical error because the order dated January 31st, which is actually a Sunday, appellant filed the notice of appeal on February 9th, which essentially caused the district court to lose jurisdiction over the issue of correcting the clerical error. And so I believe that this court has the authority under the Bicek case to correct the clerical error to identify the correct termination date for the spousal maintenance. And based on that, Your Honors, I would request and respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's order in its entirety with the exception of correcting the clerical error. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Gilbert, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And we'll just, there we go. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did want to respond quickly to CISEC. In CISEC, again, I made it clear that that was a part of a stipulation. In the stipulation, there was a clause agreed upon the parties, which specifically provides future income, if any, of the obligor from any employment whatsoever shall not constitute grounds in whole or in part for plaintiff to seek any amendment whatsoever of the judgment and decree herein. So that was an agreement, again, reached by the parties, which is completely different from what we have now, because there was no agreement. There was no clause that would preclude Ms. Warrington from modifying the spousal maintenance award, because the parties went to trial and they received a written decision. In addition to that, Euchre should be controlling in this case. The Court of Appeals directive, it makes it clear that the income at the time when the judgment and decree is entered, that's the income that the court should be looking at, which is consistent with Euchre. I still don't know where or how we're looking at speculation of what income may be in the future and speculation that was made at the time of trial. Again, it should be based upon what income is from the last modified court order and at the time when the motion was filed. Additionally, Ms. Warrington made significant efforts to try to increase her income and rehabilitate. She started her own brokerage firm. She invested tens of thousands of dollars doing that. She also started a real estate business, and she's being faulted for trying to make a living. If you look at Hecker and Flaherty, the recourse if a spouse doesn't rehabilitate is to impute income to that spouse, which is exactly what the district court did here. And the district court imputed $89,000 to Ms. Warrington, even though at the last hearing, she was earning negative income.
Mr. Gilbert, I don't think the district court is necessarily faulting her for trying to make money. I think the issue is that I think the district court was under the impression she'd be doing it in the profession that she was in, and that there seemed to be some questions with respect to the real estate and how that income was actually being reported.
Your Honor, I mean, there's no reference in the decree to her investments. Really, it's just a retirement investment in a self-directed IRA. Under the IRS guidelines, she can't really exert effort towards it. She did have other real estate interests that she managed, and she didn't earn significant income, but that was something her clients were interested in, and that's how she got into that area. She had a lengthy affidavit describing the downturn of the commodities business, which she had been a part of for over 25 years. But again, if you look at Hecker and Flaherty, the spouses in those cases, they made minimal to no effort to rehabilitate. And what's made clear in both those cases is the Court of Appeals has said the proper remedy is to impute income to those spouses, which is exactly what happened in those cases. And in those cases, the court found that there is still significant need for support. And in both those cases, the court recast the temporary maintenance award as a permanent award and left it open for later modification, which is exactly what we asked the court to do here. There's no discussion whatsoever, despite there being a huge change in circumstances across the board with regard to respondents' income and appellant's reduction in income. There's no discussion whatsoever regarding her ability to meet her needs. If you take the district court's factual findings at face value, if her income is $89,000 per year, or about $7,000 per month, there's no way she can meet her monthly expenses of $13,000 per month as found in the judgment and decree. So that is a huge shortfall. All the case law described looking at the need of the spousal maintenance recipient, and you can't really analyze what's fair and reasonable if you're not looking at the need. In fact, 518A.39 provides, if there's a substantial change, all the factors in 518.552 must be examined by the court, which simply just did not happen here. Again, given the significant change in circumstances, we do ask as a matter of law that the spousal maintenance award be recast as a permanent award, and that spousal maintenance be increased so Ms. Warrington can meet her monthly living expenses. Thank you.
Thank you both. Both of you have presented, as you did previously, extensive arguments and briefing, and we appreciate that. We will be issuing an order, or we'll be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you both. That the case now is submitted.